It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up later in the hour, Kyle Munson of the Des Moines Register tells us about the medical mystery of a Cedar Falls boy who has had no urge to eat or drink for the past year and the huge international response that story has received coming up in our second half hour. But first, with the Ebola outbreak and the U.S. elections, we've given less attention in recent weeks to developments in Ukraine, and there has been a lot happening there, including their own elections. If you remember, this started back in April when armed separatists took over government buildings in Donetsk and Luhansk and declared a People's Republic in both regions, loyal to Moscow instead of Kiev. At least 3,700 people have been killed in the fighting. Many more have fled to other parts of Ukraine or to Russia. Yesterday, Ukraine and Russia and the European Union signed a deal that will see Moscow resume vital supplies of natural gas to its ex-Soviet neighbor over the winter. It's an agreement that comes as the conflict rumbles on despite a ceasefire with pro-Russian rebels in eastern Ukraine. Joining me now with their perspectives on the gas deal, on the elections, and on the conflict, Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Hello, Jim.
Hello.
Also joining us from Ukraine, Roman Skaskiu. He's a writer, also a software developer. He lives in Lviv, that's in western Ukraine, also a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop and a former infantry officer who served tours of duty in Afghanistan and a tour of duty in Iraq. Joining us via Skype, Roman, are you there?
I am here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us, Roman. Let's talk about the gas deal. So much to talk about. Jim, give us the basics. How was this gas deal reached finally?
Well, this gas deal was just reached within the past sort of 24 hours here, and it's a $4.6 billion gas deal, basically funded by the European Union and the International Monetary Fund, and it's a deal between Russia and Ukraine, which basically provides that gas will be running to Ukraine at least through March, and more importantly as well for the Europeans, that it means that gas will be transported across Ukraine into Europe, and so that they will have gas for the upcoming winter here.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's very important for, frankly, all three parties, that is the European Union, which guarantees gas supplies to their member states. It's obviously important for Ukraine in terms of having gas supplies for the winter. But it's also very much an incentive for Russia because, of course, in my view, some of the sanctions that have been put on have actually harmed Russia, the Russian economy. And, of course, this is a boon in terms of the their own economy here.
Roman, in Ukraine, what is the reaction among Ukrainians in your area to the gas deal? Relief?
I think it is mostly relief. Russia has been so unpredictable, making promises and breaking them. I think there's a little bit of skepticism that this could still change at any moment. But generally, it is a sign of relief, although it does recall some level of cynicism. I don't think this is as important news as it is in the West, because the gas thing always happens with very powerful oligarchs. And some people have the feeling that when there's money to be made, the gas will flow. It's the gas is determined by money and by political leverage exerted by the Kremlin. So it was a toss-up between the two. But people are hugely suspicious of the gas industry in general and suspicious of Putin that things might change at any moment.
How worried were and are Ukrainians about limited gas supplies during the winter? Was there an alternative for most Ukrainians? Because Ukrainian winters get really cold.
They do, although about as cold as the Iowa winter, I would think. Most people, especially in the part of the country that I'm in, they're very proud right now. They feel like this is a long overdue divorce, and if they have to be cold for one winter or chop wood, they were ready to do that.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the elections, because we're between elections. Last Sunday, pro-Western parties leading after the elections last Sunday, Roman, Ukraine's national parliamentary elections. Voting did not take place in the rebel-held eastern districts or in the Crimea, which Russia annexed in March.
Right.
This coming Sunday, the controversial separatist elections planned in those provinces in eastern Ukraine. Russia has said it will recognize the results there, but Ukraine and Western governments say those elections should not go ahead. Tell us, how are those elections seen? Let's talk about the elections that were passed. It's being called a watershed election, Roman, in Ukraine's post-Soviet history. What are the significance of these results?
I think more significant is the change in the people's mentality, but in general, it's very significant. It's sort of a civilizational shift of Ukraine towards Europe and away from Russia. The Ukrainian national myth is that they're an ancient civilization, which in the 12th century was one of the biggest political structures in Europe, and since then, since getting sacked by the Mongols, it suffered misfortune, mostly at the hands of the Russians, who earlier were called the Muscovites. So this is, a lot of Ukrainians see this as sort of a restoration of their dignity after many, many centuries. And I think that's happening, and I think ultimately what's happening here might make Russians a freer people, because they're going to see this war on corruption that's happening here very imperfectly. It's still a huge level of corruption, but things have changed for the better, and I think it ultimately might make the Russians more free, even though the Kremlin is trying to sell this whole thing as an anti-Russian movement. It's not. It's an anti-tyranny movement and an anti-corruption movement.
So has the conflict in the east sort of unified the rest of Ukraine that's not in those provinces? Is that what you're saying, that instead of pro-Russian and pro-European parties, that everybody is on board being pro-European, more or less?
Everybody's on board being anti-corruption and anti-tyranny. Even though this was originally started as protests against the EU, as soon as the government cracked down on the protests back in November and December, these protests were about overthrowing the government. They were never anti-Russian. There were a lot of Russians on Maidan protesting alongside the Ukrainians. Now, anti-corruption protests are very terrifying to the corrupt regime in Moscow. So huge Russian propaganda assets have been mobilized to make this seem like an anti-Russian movement. Mm. But it never was.
Jim McCormick, give us your view of the significance of the elections this past Sunday.
Well, I think they're very significant for the West. Of course, you know, Ukraine has always been sort of that pivot state in Central Europe, whether they would turn towards the West or remain looking east. And I think the results there, that the three major parties that won the most seats in the parliament here now are going to be Western-oriented. It means, I think, that the European Union deal that was agreement that was signed by Poroshenko after he took control, I think, can go forward. But I think, as Roman talks about, I mean, the real challenge, it seems to me, and what the West is going to be looking for, is whether this kind of corruption will be addressed. Will there really be reforms? Because even with remaining within the parliament, as I look at the election results, there are going to be the opposition bloc from the previous regime, and how much will they be, you know, obstructionist? They may not have the total amount of votes, but they could be very, very disruptive, it seems to me. I think the other challenge, and maybe Roman can talk about this more specifically, the two leading parties that were elected obviously have some differences, the prime minister and the president. I would be interested in his take on how much they will really cooperate, because there have been, they have been at each other a bit here, and I'm wondering how that will affect the efforts to get these kind of corruption reforms.
Roman Skaskiw in Ukraine.
That's on a lot of people's minds. I don't really have an answer. I can only say that this sort of an echo of what happened in 2004 when the Orange Revolution swept more pro-Western politicians into office. And they descended very quickly into bitter infighting. So I don't have any prediction, but it is on a lot of people's minds. I wanted to add that there was a beautiful saying with regards to whether this is a European movement. There was a beautiful expression I heard about the protests. A young man said, "I came to Maidan looking for Europe, and I found Ukraine." That's such a beautiful way to put it.
Yeah.
And even after the brutal regime was deposed, the Yanukovych regime was deposed, support for Europe was not overwhelming. I believe it was around 60%, and support for NATO membership was only 40%. That's after they overthrew the president. These numbers only skyrocketed after Russia invaded. So Ukrainians, there was this great feeling of self-help, like we could do this ourselves. It's only now that we need protection, military protection, and help fighting against the Russians that the support for EU membership or NATO membership has gone up.
Think there really would be a movement towards NATO membership? I mean, that has been, of course, one of the crux of the issues for Russia here is that if Ukraine
Yes.
get into NATO, and of course the United States has been extremely cautious on that in terms of the implications of that in terms of U.S. and really Western relations with Russia. I'd be interested in your take on that. Is there really been a more of a movement towards NATO? I think Poroshenko's position has been that, he will not move. He might move on the EU, but not on NATO.
At the time that the regime was deposed, I believe it was around 40% support, and it's gone up to about 50% support in reaction to the invasion, 50-55, if I'm not mistaken. What I think is the best long-term plan is to create a union of Poland and the Baltic states and Ukraine to respond to Russian aggression. My own feeling is that NATO has too many mixed interests and mixed alliances. Germany has been perceived as being soft on Russia because of all their economic ties, and I think it sort of handicaps a military response to a Russian invasion. So in the long term, that's what I think would be better, a union of Poland, Ukraine, the Baltic states, possibly Georgia.
Maybe
But
seeing the
right
future,
now, the
yeah, future
feeling
has a
is that we
strong
can use all the
future.
help we can get.
I mean, Poland, of course, would have, I think, considerable clout with their ties to NATO and the efforts of the U.S. to enhance their military posture. But would you think that Ukraine could add sufficient leverage, if you will, to be credible?
Well, right now Ukrainians are the ones who are willing and to fight and doing the fighting. Like they're the ones making it happen. I think that surprised everybody. I think the Kremlin calculated that Ukrainians were so demoralized that they wouldn't resist an invasion at all. I think a lot of people have been startled by this war.
Roman and Jim, let me break in here and remind our listeners, perhaps some listeners who have just joined us. Jim McCormick is in Ames, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Roman Skaskiw is joining us from Ukraine, where he lives and works via Skype. He's a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop, also a veteran of the U.S. Military. In the remaining time, let me get to a couple of other points here. Roman, you talked about the mythology here of the Ukrainian nation there. What are the competing narratives about Ukraine's identity? We have a different narrative coming from Russia and from the president.
Yes, yeah, so Russia says that they are the great uniters and the natural centers of this great brotherhood of Slavic people. That's the narrative promoted by Dugin, a Kremlin ideologue. Putin has echoed this narrative in many of his speeches. Ukrainians will say that they stole the name Russian. There was a kingdom centered on Kiev in the 12th century called Kievan Rus, and that Ukrainians draw their identity from there. And they say after the Mongols sacked Kievan Rus in the 13th century, Ukraine became very weak and Moscow rose to power and only adopted the name Russian in the 18th century. Tsar Peter, who was originally the Tsar of Muscovy, changed the name of all the people he conquered to Russians, drawing the name from Kievan Rus. So I think this conflict is a huge, it's a huge identity crisis for Russia because they see Ukraine as sort of the cultural well of the greater Russian people.
Looking forward to the Sunday vote. This is when the separatists have said they will vote. And Jim, this is a vote that would grant themselves the limited self-rule, the ability to break away from Ukraine.
Yes, that's right. I mean, they declared that, they would have these elections and they would, set up a parliament, then elect some constitutional officers and so on. It appears to me is a direct violation of the Minsk agreement that was made between Ukraine and Moscow or Russia in September here, because it did. Poroshenko's view is that he would allow for some regionalism to take place, but only as long as that regionalism remained within Ukraine. So I guess my concern would be that, especially since Moscow said they'll recognize the results of the November 2nd election here, my concern will be, will this exacerbate conflict even more, or will it be just simply seen as sort of an action without very much meaning? And maybe Roman on the ground there can give us a view of what the Ukrainian people, how they would view the outcome there.
Yeah, Roman in Ukraine.
The view is mixed. Many people have long regarded Donetsk as just the center for corruption in this country. And I have written earlier, before this whole conflict started, that separatism would be a great thing for Ukraine. My sentiments have changed slightly. There have been many surveys, both by international organizations and local organizations, that show the true sentiment in those parts of Ukraine. It's about 20% of people support separatism outright, 15 or 10% support Russia, and slightly over half support Ukraine. It's just that minority that supports either separatism or joining Russia, they've been very heavily armed, and in their name, a whole thousands and thousands of mercenaries have arrived. So it's a shame for those people from those regions that wanna stay Ukrainian, and there is no chance that this will be a fair election. It'll be a repeat of Crimea, where you'll see 96, 97% of the people voting the way the Kremlin wants them to vote.
How likely is it, Roman, and then Jim, your view on this too, that of course the big concern that these parts of Ukraine would go the way of Crimea and be annexed by Russia. How likely does that look in your view, Roman?
I think more likely they will create another Abkhazia. That's the name of the region that Russia took from Georgia and made kind of a quasi-state, or the way of Transnistria. That's the territory that Russia took from Moldova and made into a sort of quasi-state. And many of the leaders of the so-called Donetsk People's Republic were active in Abkhazia, Georgia, or in Transnistria, Moldova. So it's the same crew coming into other countries and creating fake rebellions, which they can then turn into quasi-states and have sustained political leverage. I don't think it would be a tragedy for Ukraine as a whole. If those regions were lost politically, the rest of Ukraine might be stronger. But I think it's a tragedy for the slim majority, for the plurality and slim majority of people in those regions who want to remain with Ukraine. My hope is that in the long run, there will be a big economic contrast between Ukraine and Russia, and that this anti-corruption movement will spread to Moscow. That won't happen for a long time because Moscow is very good at cracking down at civil unrest. There was one former KGB officer who says that today Russian intelligence has one officer for every 300 Russians. Imagine if there was an FBI agent for every 300 Americans. So Russian society is very heavily controlled. But at the same time, I can only hope that good ideas about anti-corruption and economic freedom will only spread.
Jim McCormick in Ames, your thoughts?
I think Russia would not actually formally annex it as they did with Crimea. Crimea is a little bit different because of its placement on the Black Sea and the Russian fleet and so on. I think that the response of the West has already affected Russia in terms of capital development here and capital flight. There has been an impact on the currency, so I don't think Putin at this juncture would take that action, Oil prices have dropped, as you know, worldwide, down to around the $80 figure. So Russia would be hurt even, you know, has been hurt and would be hurt even more. So I think what Roman has outlined is this kind of quasi-state, you know, where Russia has predominant influence is the more likely outcome. The one question that I have in looking at this a little bit is that apparently on the economic side, this Donbas region is actually quite important for Ukraine in terms of their GDP. And
Roman Skaskiw, I have to ask you as we conclude this conversation, you are a writer, you're a software developer, you're living now, and we're talking to you as you are in Ukraine. You're in Lviv in western Ukraine, a large city there. People can follow your blog at romaninukraine.com. You're a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop in Iowa City, also Stanford University School of Engineering, and also a former infantry officer. You served two tours of duty in Afghanistan, one tour in Iraq. As a former infantry officer, I wonder, do you ever feel like, as a Ukrainian-American, taking up arms there?
I do, but I don't think I would fight for Donbass. It's really hard to win, and there the population is they're too split, and I also fear the incompetence of the Ukrainian military leadership. But of course, it's hard not to imagine it. You know, 6 years of my life were spent in the military.
Mm-hmm. Has this conflict and being in Ukraine really made you rediscover another part of your identity? Your parents are Ukrainian. You grew up in New York City, came to Iowa for the Writers' Workshop, but this is a huge touchstone, contact with your parents' culture and your culture.
Yeah, I should write more about that. It's been a great experience. I felt so proud when this revolution happened. I'm so glad that I got to live through it. It's the reassertion of Ukrainian identity after all those centuries.
Roman Skaskiw, thank you for joining us from Ukraine, and we'll look for further updates from you. Be well.
Thank you, sir.
Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Always wonderful to have your expertise, Jim. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
Coming up in just a moment, Kyle Munson of the Des Moines Register tells us about the medical mystery of a Cedar Falls boy who has had no urge to eat or drink for the past year. That's when News Buzz continues. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Thank you.